From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After co-creating The Mary Tyler Moore Show and Rhoda, James Brooks went on to produce The Tracy Ullman Show and The Simpsons. His new movie, I'll Do Anything, is a comedy about the movie industry. It co-stars Julie Kavner, who first worked with Brooks when she played Rhoda's sister. Then she co-starred on The Tracy Ullman Show, and now she's the voice of Marge Simpson. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with James Brooks and Julie Kavner. Tonight on television, Robert Culp and Bill Cosby reunite in I Spy Returns. David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. In about an hour, President Clinton is expected to announce that he's lifting the American trade embargo against Vietnam. Businesses have been calling for the right to buy from and sell to Vietnam because many European and Asian nations are already making inroads into that market. Some U.S. veterans of the Vietnam War and families of soldiers still missing from the war have protested against lifting the trade embargo. They say it keeps pressure on Vietnam to account for missing Americans. But some members of Congress who are veterans of the war, including a former POW, Senator John McCain, have supported the lifting of the trade ban. The Senate Armed Services Committee has unanimously endorsed President Clinton's choice for Secretary of Defense. William Perry's name will now go on to the full Senate for a vote. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
Perry, currently the number two official at the Pentagon, appeared before the Armed Services Committee just yesterday for his confirmation hearing. It was clear then that the nominee would have no problem with confirmation. Committee Chairman Sam Nunn says he hopes the full Senate will confirm Perry by this evening. That vote is expected to be overwhelming, if not unanimous, in Perry's favor. Perry was nominated to succeed Defense Secretary Les Aspin just last week. President Clinton's first choice, Bobby Inman, asked that his name be withdrawn. Perry said at his confirmation hearing that he was ready to take on the task of Defense Secretary. Chairman Nunn said Perry is highly qualified and is capable of serving with distinction. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Britain says it will present new proposals for a political settlement in Northern Ireland within 2 weeks. NPR's Andy Bowers reports from London.
In an interview with the Financial Times of London, Britain's Northern Ireland Secretary, Sir Patrick Mayhew, says the proposal will recommend setting up a new assembly to govern the troubled province. Northern Ireland has been governed directly from London since 1972. Mayhew also says he sees areas where the North and the mainly Catholic Republic of Ireland to the South could cooperate, such as on tourism. The move comes just as the leader of the Irish Republican Army's political branch, Gerry Adams, was returning from a highly visible trip to the U.S., where he criticized Britain for not working hard enough to find a peaceful settlement. The British government was angered and embarrassed by the trip, and Mayhew's proposal is seen as an attempt to seize back the moral high ground now that Adams has returned to Belfast. I'm Andy Bowers in London.
The government says orders to U.S. factories rose 1.2% in December. That's the fifth increase in a row. And the Commerce Department says for all of 1993, factory orders rose 5.9%, and that's the largest yearly gain since 1988. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 8 points at 3967.10 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is down more than 2 points. This is NPR News. The World Court has rejected Libya's claim to a strip of land in northern Chad. It's desolate but rich in minerals. The two countries have gone to war twice over it. The court says Chad's ownership was effectively determined by a 1955 treaty between Libya and France, Chad's colonial ruler. Libya had claimed no border was set by the treaty. It also argued that as a newly independent country, it was at a negotiating disadvantage. Libya had gained independence from Italy 4 years earlier in 1951. The deputy defense minister of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia was assassinated today in a bomb explosion at his home in Tbilisi. The incident happened only hours before Russian President Boris Yeltsin arrived in the Georgian capital for talks between leaders of the two nations. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Nika Kekalina Kalidze was killed instantly when a bomb wrecked his apartment in Tbilisi. Georgia's defense minister, Georgi Karkarashvili, was injured in a second explosion, apparently a booby trap, when he arrived at the scene. The defense ministry described the attack as a terrorist act carried out by forces opposed to a Russian-Georgian military pact that was signed when Russian President Yeltsin met later with Georgia's leader, Edward Shevardnadze. That agreement permits the continued presence of Russian military bases in Georgia. It also commits Moscow to provide weapons and training to the Georgian army. Yeltsin's visit to Tbilisi lasted for just a few hours and was held under tight security. It capped months of sensitive negotiations after Georgia appealed for Russian military support to put down a series of rebel uprisings last year that threatened to break apart the fragile Georgian state. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
NASA reports a map-making satellite has successfully begun its mission with the firing of thrusters that moved Clementine 1 out of Earth's orbit. The spacecraft is on its way to map the surface of the moon. After the satellite leaves the moon's orbit, it will investigate an asteroid. I'm Barbara Campbell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is one of the creative forces behind some of the more innovative TV shows of the past 25 years. James Brooks is a writer and executive producer whose credits include The Mary Tyler Moore Show and its spin-offs Rhoda and Lou Grant, Taxi, The Tracey Ullman Show, The Simpsons, and the new animated comedy The Critic. He also wrote and directed the films Terms of Endearment and Broadcast News. His new movie, I'll Do Anything, opens this Friday. It's a comedy about the movie business. Nick Nolte plays a character actor who isn't considered sexy enough to get leading man roles. He's having a hard time making ends meet, and to make matters worse, his ex-wife, played by Tracey Ullman, has just informed him that he's about to assume full-time custody of their 6-year-old daughter. Now he needs a part desperately. He gets an audition with a self-absorbed producer, played by Albert Brooks, who churns out formula films. In this scene, Brooks is supposed to be interviewing Nolte for a part in a new movie, but Brooks spends the whole meeting making speeches about his philosophy of filmmaking.
You know, there are all different ways. Do you know Bertolucci never reads actors? Just looks at them, feels around a little bit, and then he decides. Doesn't read a word. Well, I also have a way. I like to interview first, then I like to read, maybe come back the next day, do it all over again. I'll call people up the actor's worked with, I'll check him out. If he's famous, I'll do an opinion survey to see if people like him. If he's not famous, I'll put him on tape, grab anybody I can find and show him the tape. That's the way I like to do it. I believe in screen tests. I believe in cutting people out if the dailies are bad. I believe in replacing people if the previews aren't there, because I don't make movies for theaters that serve cappuccino in the lobby. I make popcorn movies.
It's possible that in the original version of the film, Albert Brooks ended his spiel by breaking out into song. James Brooks made I'll Do Anything as a musical, but the songs flopped at test screenings, so Brooks deleted the songs and reworked the film.
If I had a list in my ambitions for the picture, I think, you know, the top of the list would that it be real and that it be funny. I don't know what's more important to me than those two things. And I thought the music would somehow, because it dealt with a 6-year-old child and dealt with Hollywood, make it more real, let it become a little deeper, and it had the exact opposite effect. And I've had things like this happen before, and I think, you know, practically everybody has. Usually what post-production is about is going in front of an audience and finding your picture, finding the picture that wants to happen. I mean, in Broadcast News, I lost a subplot that I really loved. In Terms of Endearment, a scene that I was particularly proud of because I thought I'd found a way to really look into where we were going with medical health, and I thought it was, like, bizarre and funny and true. I mean, those are two things that I lost in those previous films. Nothing is dramatic like this, never changed form the way this one has. I don't think any picture ever has. But it was on that same road, so it wasn't that wild to me. What was wild this time is that it became public. And I was forced to talk about it at this, you know, early first draft stage. That was rough.
Yeah. Why was that such a bad thing for you?
Because to do your work, you want privacy. It's like anybody. There's a certain kind of work you do where you need privacy, where you need to close the door. And this time when I went to close the door, there were like 9 feet sticking in it.
Well, how much do you trust screening audiences? And do you trust them over your own intuition about a scene?
No. You're doing a picture to communicate. And you're doing these screenings to get a communication. First of all, you absolutely trust whether they're laughing or not laughing. There's no mistake about that. You always, it's anybody who's been to these will tell you when you sit down, you're suddenly, you gain objectivity by virtue of just sitting there with them. Before you hear anything or read anything, you're looking at your film differently. The thing that you couldn't possibly cut a day or so, you're tearing out on the drive home from the screening. This always happens. The thing you can't get from them is what they want, and the thing you can't get from them is, if you do this, I'll be happy. I mean, if you try and do that, you're crazy. Also, you can't get anything from the raw numbers, I think. You get something, you get an analytical book about how this figures it with the norm, that you know, and that's your testing score. But there's, I mean, you have to get, if you read 400 cards from strangers who have seen your movie, what usually happens is you see a theme. It's like if you're doing, I always think if you're doing research, the third time you hear something, you begin to think you found something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you just, in broadcast news, there was about the third time I heard somebody talk about a woman under a lot of work pressure, the third woman who said she cries in the course of the day pretty frequently, I knew that it had to be in the picture. When you do this kind of research, sometimes a theme will come up. You find out what they're thinking. You're reading these cards, but you're really having this unusual conversation with people about your work. It's valuable.
But let me ask you, do you think that I'll Do Anything really should have been a musical? Do you miss the songs? Do you like the original film that you had?
Yeah, I do, but I'm convinced that it worked against what I wanted to do in an audience situation. I think people watching it alone can take the leap. Sure, I liked it. I've never seen anything like it in my life. It was very unusual. And it still had the script that I cared so much about. But this is the movie that should have been made, the one that's coming out now. You know, it was a strange route to take, but this is the movie that I think is the best movie.
James Brooks is my guest. His new movie is I'll Do Anything. I have this thing about some movies that when when a woman is supposed to be not glamorous, what you have to do is like cast a glamorous star and just not have her wear as much makeup, and that only beautiful women are allowed to be unattractive in most films. And Nick Nolte plays someone who's supposed to not be sexy enough to get leading man roles, but of course Nick Nolte has actually played leading man roles in real life.
And of course Nick Nolte spent a lot of time not being able to get those leading man roles.
Was that true? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
I read that People magazine voted him the sexiest man of the year or something.
Yeah,
so
that was,
it was kind of ironic.
That was, you know, this whole adventure is filled with ironies. Nick was picked sexiest man of the year as we were discussing whether he could do the part, because I had the same reservations you did, and he kept on telling me, believe me, I know what my inner life is. I never experienced myself as this. And then this People magazine cover happened. He sent me the cover with his teeth blacked out and a mustache on him and a scar painted on him. But the conversation he had with me was a man who was truly awkward and embarrassed of being on that cover in that way. And that conversation was as close as I've heard Nick come to, at that time, to the character that he had to play.
Mm-hmm. James Brooks, in addition to your movies, which include the new film I'll Do Anything, Terms of Endearment, Broadcast News, you're responsible for some, you know, fantastic TV shows. You co-created Mary Tyler Moore and Rhoda, Taxi, The Simpsons, now The Critic. Where do you think you have more freedom, on television or film?
Television taught me freedom. I mean, there's... if you have a half-hour show that, you know, when we did the Mary Tyler Moore show, I came in one day, and my partner's on the phone. We picked it up with the guy who was then a CBS vice president of programming, sort of key vice president. And he was having us go through the script saying, why would anybody laugh at that? Why would you think that's funny? You know, the kind of test that no comedy can pass, one individual saying, I don't think that's funny. And then we got ratings. And then we never heard from him again. We never had to clear a story again. We never had to talk about a script again. We had to please ourselves. And television is great training in creative freedom, because if you have a show that works within the framework of good taste, you have total, and the time restraints, you have total creative freedom. And it's a good lesson to learn.
Whereas in film, you're starting from scratch each time, right?
Bosses, the stakes are bigger. Sometimes you have to go through committee, you know. But if a guy comes from television, you know, you have to know, you have to feel the freedom to know you want it and to know what to do with it. And some very talented people, it takes them too long to be able to feel the freedom and know it's there, know what that air, you know, smells like.
Do writers have more power? Are writers considered more important on television?
Yes. No question, by 1,000,000%.
Why is this?
Because I think because if a series works, the thing it starts to do is devour material. Television devours material, so the writer becomes really important. And also in multiple camera television, you know, there isn't as much variety in how you can make it look. I mean, you can be innovative, you can still direct it very well, but there are real limitations. So it tends to be about the script.
Mm-hmm. Well, just in time for the reviews of your new film, you've launched a new comedy, an animated comedy on TV about a bad film critic who hosts a movie review
show.
Who
says he's bad?
Well, why did you want to do a comedy about a critic?
This took a long route, and it was a lot of, you know, a lot of serendipity, I think. It started out as a regular show that was going to be about the makeup woman on a Good Morning America-type television show, and there was going to be a movie critic in it. And then we started to focus on the movie critic, and then I saw a friend's film, League of Their Own, and I saw John Lovitz in it and went crazy. And then we wanted to do it about the critic, and then he got so many movie jobs he couldn't do a series, so we decided to make it animated. That's the whole story.
Oh, that's why it was animated, because Lovitz wasn't available?
Yeah, but as it turned out, it all meets together because it's animated, we can do takeoffs on movies which are impossible in any other form.
When you first started to do The Simpsons, was there a lot of resistance to an animated series?
Yes. Yes, enormous. And we fought really hard. And first they said, we'll let you try it as a special, and we refused, and we wanted to commit to a series. And it took a long time, and eventually they committed to a series. And then it was, you know, it was particularly tense because when we got back the first show, it looked awful. And when you do animation, you record it, you write it, you record it, and then you wait 6 months to see your film because that's how long the animation takes. So here it is. We've been doing shows all along, and the first one came back, and it was awful. And we were shell-shocked. And we didn't know whether it was the group that had worked on that particular show or whether there was something in the mix. Because if you go off-model, that's what they call it when you draw the characters slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
And The Simpsons looked grotesque because there was just fractions of differences in the way they were drawn. And we had to wait for 1 week before we saw the next show and knew whether it was all over or not. And the next show was The Simpsons as we know it now.
So what did you do with that first show that you didn't like?
We repaired it.
Oh, good. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the history of your career. You started off writing TV news. Who did you write for? What kind of copy did you have to write?
Well, I wrote news shows. I wrote news shows for radio and television. I was a news writer,
mm-hmm.
Union news writer.
So were you writing for Ted Baxter types or for network news anchors?
Both. And there was a difference in those days.
How much did the Mary Tyler Moore Show have its genesis in your writing TV news?
Enormous. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there were, you know, Lou Grant was modeled after a great news editor who was at CBS who died in a plane crash. He was modeled after him.
Mm-hmm.
And Ted Baxter was modeled after people that I didn't work with, but people we did some research that we had witnessed. And, enormous.
And what about the Mary character?
Mary, no. Mary, we just looked for the woman she'd be and put her in that environment. I mean, the first show had her joining that environment. She wasn't part of it until the first show.
Mm-hmm. No, the Mary Tyler Moore Show really broke a lot of new ground. It was a series about an independent woman who's single. Most of the series took place at work as opposed to at home. She had an interesting job. Did you think of this as breaking new ground, or did you just come up with that idea?
The great thing is that the feminist movement started, like, you know, 8 minutes after the show started. It was just this. So that we were able to draw on it for passion and for story material. That was, you know, so it is that thing of we had the right show at exactly the right time.
My guest is James Brooks. He wrote and directed the new movie, I'll Do Anything, which opens tomorrow. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with James Brooks. Is there like common wisdom about how many laughs per 5 minutes there needs to be in a good sitcom? Do you subscribe to any of that?
I think you have to have a laugh just before your sweat gland starts sending a message to you. I don't know what it is on the clock.
Okay.
But, there, you know, it depends on the scene. You have to trust a scene. I mean, you know, sometimes you have to know when to not do a laugh. There was a very key line in the movie that I just finished, very key line, perhaps the most important line in the movie, that got a wonderful laugh. And the place sort of exploded with it because I had her express something, the six-year-old child express something in absolute child's jargon. And it was so delightful that the audience just erupted into laughter. But it followed the most emotional moment in the picture. And it's real tough to take out a laugh that big. And I finally did and put in a line that left only the emotion. Every once in a while, you have to do that, too.
Did it hurt to do that?
Yeah, I think it was the right thing to do. It was a very tough choice. It was as tough as anything.
Did you grow up watching a lot of family sitcoms?
No, not a lot. I mean, we were not to go for sympathy, but we were quite poor, and it was a long time before we could afford a set.
How old were you when you got it?
I think I was like 14 or something like that.
Well, that's pretty old.
Yeah.
So what was on then?
What shows did I like? Well, Lucy was like amazing. You know, I mean, I remember loving that. But I think the first show that I went and, you know, and this is after I think I was able to buy myself a set then. But the show that I went absolutely crazy over was the Dick Van Dyke Show. I mean, I just couldn't believe that people could be that witty. And just the fact that it was about doing a television show, that the show was about that. And all these people were having these great times and these funny people got in a room and were friends with each other. I just went nuts over it. Everybody did.
So Dick Van Dyke was really one of the first shows you watched.
I don't know whether it was one of the first shows I watched. Like an experience you can have with a book where it becomes part of your life, where it's so special to you. I had that kind of experience with the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Did that have anything to do with you working with Mary Tyler Moore later?
Well, it meant that I went crazy when I got the chance.
Did you write it for her?
Yes. Myself and Alan Burns.
One of the themes in both Broadcast News and in your new movie, I'll Do Anything, is like how much of your life you devote to... You obsessively devote to work, and how much of your life you kind of devote to relationships, to people, to family, and friends. Has this been a big issue for you?
Well, obsessive is such an editorial word. I think it's an issue to all of us. I think it's an issue to all of us, and I think we've got to be careful with how we editorialize, because my work sometimes assumes an extraordinary importance to me. And obviously, the key relationships in my life are extraordinarily important to me, obviously. But I should be able to say obviously about my work is I don't think there's a shame in caring about your work. I don't think there's anything wrong with experiencing like it's life or death. I think if you think you're larger than your work, there's something wrong with it. I think if you're not humbled by your work, something can get wrong with it. You know, if you get inflated by it in a certain way and distorted by your work, there's something wrong with it. But if you really respect what you're trying to do, forget how good you are at it or anything like that, if you respect what you're trying to do and try and do it as well as you know how and feel humbled by it, it's legitimate.
Oh, hey. I wasn't trying to say you shouldn't be working hard in this.
You weren't just telling me off? That's my imagination?
I was absolutely not. I was just wondering if it's been a big issue for you.
It's a big issue, but who is it a big issue for? You know, there's this girl, Kathy, in the movie, mm-hmm. and I had a 29-year-old entertainment television broadcaster come to interview me. And, you know, I guess you have to see the movie to appreciate this, but it took some courage for her to say, I don't care, I'm Kathy. You know, and you're right. There's a line in the movie. I'll be damned if I apologize for thinking my work is important. I don't have a mate. I don't have a kid. I don't have a talent. I got this, and I'll be damned if I apologize for thinking it's important. Great. Very legitimate. I got what she was saying. I loved her for saying it. And now I met this really bright guy about 35. I should fix him up, as a matter of fact. I met this really bright guy who's a syndicated columnist and his questions were really intelligent. You could tell he was quiet and intelligent. And at the end of the interview, he says, you know, I married a Kathy and we're getting divorced now. And she bought the town just like the girl in your movie did. And I mean, in this group of weeks since I finished my movie, I'm so happy that I heard both those comments, you know, because to me, Kathy as much as any character in it, represents Hollywood and all its confusions and everything else.
What's good and what's bad about
it. Yeah, and I'm glad I heard both those comments.
Yeah. Can I make an observation that you probably won't want to hear?
Well, I'd rather you didn't.
Yeah, right. That's right. I'm setting myself up for that, aren't I? Yes, and I'll say I'll make it anyways. On some level, I think that maybe your television work has been like more innovative, taken more chances than your movies. Do you know, which isn't to say that your movies aren't good, but just that they're not trying new things in the way that some of the TV shows has.
Well, yeah, I did do that old hat comedy about cancer. And then I did that natural one about whether morality is falling apart. Listen, it's okay. I don't experience it that way. To me, every movie is an enormous chance, and television, because I'm more familiar with it, feels safer. It took a long time to get my first movie made because everybody thought it was an impossible thing to do a movie about.
In terms of endearment.
And this tends to sound self-serving, and I hope it's not. Maybe it is a little in response to your question. But the second one is you know, everybody was telling me that it was too inside. You know, you keep on hearing too inside on broadcast news. But I know how I got to broadcast news, and I know how I got to Terms of Endearment, and I know how I got to the one that I did now. And those are the ways that I want to get to everything I do for the rest of my life, if I can. I hope I do. I just know in the first case there was a book where I had an emotional reaction to it that I could not deny. In the second instance, I knew I was confused about fundamental changes taking place all around me, and I tried to find an avenue to write about it and explore it. And I know in the third place I wanted to take on myself and all these issues of parenthood and working in a confusing town that I'm drawn to and that I worry about for the last 20 years. So these are as good a reason as I'll ever come up with for doing a piece of work, and I hope the reasons stay that good. Mm. You know, I mean it.
Right. Okay.
Okay. So watch out.
Yeah. I'm watching. Gosh, I'm at a loss for words.
Why don't you knock the way I work again if you're looking for something to say?
You know what I want to wonder again? Like when you're at a screening and the audience isn't laughing at something that you think is really funny, do you ever want to get up there and say, look, don't you get this? Are you not sophisticated enough to get this joke? I mean, I'm just trying to project myself in the situation of somebody who's made a movie and the audience isn't responding in the proper way. I think I'd really want to get up there and just...
Boy, good for you. I want, you know, when that happens, I want to die at that moment. You know, and I think correctly that it is my fault. There's this great lesson that I learned. There's these moments that you recognize as I'm glad this moment happened to me because there's this tremendous lesson in it.
Right. It hurt, but I'll learn something.
Well, this one didn't hurt. It happened to somebody else, but I was there. Ha ha ha. So. We were going for, you know, on the television shows, you're always working on jokes right up until airtime.
Yeah.
And we had this one key joke that we were standing around looking for the answer to. And it was a blackout joke, a blackout meaning it's more important because it's the last joke in a scene. The scene ends on that. You better get a laugh or else you're really going to feel bad. I mean, that becomes the most important joke. So we're looking for this blackout. And somebody in the group said, how about this joke? And said the joke. And nobody said anything. It was somebody in authority, too. And he said, well, I think it's funny. And said it again. And then we're still looking for a line. And then he said that same joke. And he said, why won't that work? And somebody said to him, you know when it's working because everybody walks away, you know, and the job's done. And I think that's real true.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Good talking to you, Terry. It was really interesting.
James Brooks wrote and directed the new comedy I'll Do Anything. It opens tomorrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. One of actress Julie Kavner's greatest assets is her voice. It sounded perfectly neurotic and insecure when she launched her career on the TV series Rhoda, playing Rhoda's sister. Now as the voice of Marge Simpson, she's created a sound that perfectly matches Marge's towering beehive. Coming up, we talk to Kavner about her voice. She's now starring in the new comedy, I'll Do Anything. And TV critic David Bianculli takes a look at what's on TV tonight. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. In about half an hour, President Clinton is expected to make the long-awaited announcement that he's lifting the embargo on trade with Vietnam. Many relatives of servicemen still missing from the Vietnam War say the 19-year-old trade embargo has been keeping the pressure on Vietnam to account for missing Americans. But businesses have been pushing for an end to the ban because they say they're losing opportunities that are going to European and Asian firms. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has signed a friendship and cooperation agreement with Georgian leader Eduard Shevardnadze. It was signed today in the Georgian capital during Yeltsin's first state visit to the country. The treaty could signal a thaw in relations between Moscow and Tbilisi, which have been characterized by mutual distrust since the breakup of the former Soviet Union. But as BBC correspondent Robert Parsons reports, the treaty could be a hard sell among Georgian nationalists.
Mr. Shevardnadze has tried to put a brave face on it, but most Georgians will see the treaty with Russia as the final acceptance of the failure of their three-year-old experiment with independence. The Georgian leader has had to agree to the terms of the treaty with Russia because it represents his stricken country's best, if not only, hope for survival in its existing borders. But the price has been reacceptance of Russian domination. Georgia has agreed to let Russia keep three military bases on its territory in order to defend the southern borders of the Commonwealth of Independent States. That doesn't include Russia's two bases in Georgia's breakaway province of Abkhazia. In return, Moscow has agreed to help train and equip Georgia's ragtaggle army.
Robert Parsons in Moscow. The controversial growth hormone for cows, BST, goes on the market tomorrow. The hormone can increase their milk production by nearly 20%, but some consumers and family farmers oppose the use of the hormone. Thomas Martzel of member station WORT in Madison, Wisconsin, has more on the story.
The Foundation on Economic Trends filed a lawsuit in federal district court in Madison today against the Food and Drug Administration. The foundation filed the suit on behalf of over 40 co-plaintiffs, including family farmers, restaurant owners, and natural food stores. The plaintiffs demand the FDA overturn the approval of BST. They claim the FDA arbitrarily approved BST, allegedly ignoring certain data on the health risks of the hormone. The plaintiffs also request a mandatory labeling system for dairy products treated with BST. So far, the federal agency has resisted efforts to allow even voluntary labeling by farmers. A recent poll by the Wisconsin Agriculturalist, a magazine for state dairy farmers, revealed less than 4% of the state's 29,000 dairy farmers would use the hormone. For National Public Radio, I'm Thomas Martzel in Madison, Wisconsin.
Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 8 points. This is NPR. North Korea is warning the United States that pressure on it to open its nuclear facilities could trigger an instant response. In a broadcast statement, North Korea does not say what the response could be. The report says the Pyongyang government is able to counter an American option. Analysts say that seems to suggest North Korea does have nuclear weapons, as intelligence experts have suspected. The broadcast report is apparently in response to a Senate resolution supporting the return of nuclear weapons to South Korea if North Korea won't let nuclear inspectors visit its facilities. The U.S. Embassy in Cairo has reiterated its travel warning for Americans in Egypt. The country's largest Islamic militant group has warned foreigners to leave Egypt for their own safety. Lori Neff reports from Cairo.
The U.S. Embassy says it has no information of any specific threat against the American community here. That despite a communique issued by El Gamal El Islamiyah yesterday saying tourists and investors should leave Egypt for their own safety. The embassy has reissued an earlier travel warning advising that incidents of extremist violence are possible in Egypt. There's been no specific reaction to the militant statement from other Western embassies in Cairo. The statement was a response to this week's government raid in which seven militants were killed. It urges foreigners to leave because it says the Gamal retaliation will be extremely ferocious and strong. At least three foreigners have been killed and dozens more wounded in the Islamic militant violence that has gripped Egypt for nearly 2 years. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Cairo.
The space shuttle Discovery is in orbit above the Earth. The astronauts are scheduled for 8 days of research, and they are joined for the first time in an American mission by a Russian cosmonaut. NASA officials hope this mission will lead to other shared shuttle launches and a shared space station by the year 2001. NASA's administrator says this is the start of a new space era and will lead to a Mars mission. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Julie Kavner has a great voice. It was perfect for the part of the neurotic, insecure sister on Rhoda, the TV series which launched Kavner's career. That voice, with a little tweaking, is now best known as the voice of Marge Simpson. Here's Marge and the rest of the Simpsons sitting around the dinner table in an episode about legalized gambling coming to Springfield.
Mom, we're having a geography pageant at school, and I don't know which state to go as.
In honor of legalized gambling, why not go as the state of Nevada?
No, Nevada makes my butt look big.
Then how about going as Florida? You enjoy orange juice? Old people like you?
Dad, what do you think?
Shh.
I'm trying to teach the baby to gamble.
Why?
I got a job at Burns' Casino. As you know, it's been my lifelong dream to become a blackjack dealer.
Your lifelong dream was to be a contestant on The Gong Show, and you did it in 1977, remember?
Now Kavner is co-starring in the new comedy I'll Do Anything, set in Hollywood. Kavner plays a film marketing researcher who's in love with the shallow and vain producer she works for, played by Albert Brooks. Here's one of their typical bedroom conversations with Kavner lecturing Brooks about his shortcomings.
No woman has ever told you that you have an almost barbaric insensitivity? That you seem to have lapsed into some final cynicism where you actually believe that not only does everyone think the way you do, but only you have the courage to express it. That you seem horribly certain that everyone else is sort of pretending when they talk about love. No one's ever said that sort of thing to you.
Yeah, I heard that. But I didn't know that's what you meant by shortcomings.
I asked Julie Kavner if she had to figure out why her character is in love with this guy.
Jim wrote such a complete script, and the everything's there. Everything's there for the actors. You don't have to make anything up. And what is there in his character is he's a very attractive man. He's a very powerful man. He's good in bed. He's funny. He's also, he shares the same enthusiasm that my character does about the science of this market research business. He, of course, is hoping that this woman that I play can give him the answers, which, of course, is not possible. But he's intrigued that, you know, you can call up America and find out what they think.
Yeah, right. Your character runs the test screenings
right.
for him, his film company, where audiences are invited in and then they have to fill out questionnaires on their response to the film.
Right.
And of course, the film doesn't do well. The film's either killed or it's re-edited or something.
Right.
So do you have faith in these screenings in real life? And when it's your performance that's being evaluated by the test audience?
Well, like Jim Brooks said, you know, that you can use these this part of the process or not use it, but you can use it to, like, for instance, if it's a comedy, which this movie is, you know immediately if, you know, people are laughing or not, if the jokes work. So you can use it for that purpose. You can tell if you're getting across the point that you wanted to make, you know. So you can use it without compromising yourself. I had one favorite line that is not in the movie, but there was a scene where on one of their first dates, or the first date that my character and Albert's character had, and he drops her back off at the her place of business, and she says, "Do you want to come in and see how we do it?" And he's very excited, and he comes in, and it's the tracking room where there's like 75 people. They're all on a phone, little cubby holes, and they're all asking different questions. And he says, "Can you ever, you know, fix this information?" She says, "No, no, of course not. But sometimes I can't resist asking America a personal question." And he says, "Like what?" And she says, "When do you feel more worthless, in the mornings or the afternoons?"
I love that
yeah. So much.
Now, I think before you auditioned for the part of Rhoda's sister, for the Rhoda show, you auditioned for that part on the Mary Tyler Moore show?
Right, that's right. A year before, they had written an episode on the Mary Tyler Moore show where Rhoda's sister, who you had never seen before, was going to get married. So I auditioned for that part, and I didn't get it. They cast somebody else. And evidently they received many letters that nobody bought that that woman could be Rhoda's sister. So when Valerie got her own show a year later, it was up for grabs again. And David Davis called me back in, and I re-auditioned. And Jim's first direction in my life from him came during that audition after we did it. He said, "Maybe you should do this standing up."
The audition?
Yeah.
What's the difference?
Well, I think it had to do with energy. When you stand up and you're moving and you're acting out the scene more. So he was giving me great direction even then.
Because you were introduced to the American public in the role of Brenda Morgenstern, people would always wonder, like, what connection is there between the character and you? And she was a very... she had a bad self-image, you know, very self-conscious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did that connect with your life at all?
I don't know if I ever had a really bad self-image. Or if I did, I hope I've grown out of it. You know, that's one great thing of getting older. You know, after you turn 40, you can kind of, I feel the benefit of that, as you can say, you know, you can't screw around with me anymore. I'm 40. I'm an adult.
Who do you have that attitude toward?
The world.
Uh-huh.
Yourself included.
Yeah, I'll be good. Was it hard for you to get roles when the series ended? Did you feel you were typecast in that part?
Well, I definitely didn't want to repeat myself as to this day. I mean, my interest in acting is to explore other lives and other people and other situations. So I was very careful not to do anything that, you know, smacked of the Brenda character. And I wound up doing dinner theater in Canada.
Wow.
Is that
wow.
far enough away yeah, for you?
That'll do. Was it depressing to be doing dinner theater after having a big part on a TV series?
Well, actually, it was great because I came from theater. That was my background. And it was in Canada. And I love Canada. I really just a complete generalization. But the Canadians are a wonderful group of humans, and of course this is major generalization, but it was in Edmonton, and that's really Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a wonderful play that I did with Ray Buchtanica, who played the Benny Goodwin character on the Rhoda show. She was Brenda's boyfriend, who worked in the toll booth, and we did this play called "It Had to Be You" that was written by Renee Taylor and Joseph Bologna, and it was, you know, it was a short, it was like 8 weeks run. It wasn't a lifetime, so it was a very funny play, and we had a good time.
So, how long were you in dinner theater?
I did it. I did that play there, and I did it in Winnipeg. So, oh, and I also did a play. I did a before that, while the Rhoda show was going on during a hiatus, I did a dinner theater. I did two for the Seesaw, Burt Reynolds Dinner Theater in Florida with Martin Sheen, directed by Burt Reynolds. So that was great. Dinner theater is not always as bad as you think it is because they've already eaten.
The scary thing about dinner theater, though, is it has the reputation of being the place where has-beens and never has-beens and never have-beens perform. You know what I mean? So it seems like it would feel a little bit like Siberia if you were acting.
Not really.
Mm-hmm.
Not really. I've been very lucky in my career. I've always been working with really wonderful people.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what it's about.
My guest is Julie Kavner. She's co-starring in the new movie, I'll Do Anything. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with actress Julie Kavner. So how did Woody Allen cast you in... You've been in several of his films. How did he cast you in Hannah and Her Sisters?
I got a call out of the blue, which I thought was like a prank call or a joke call. You know, did I want to be in a Woody Allen movie? And that was it.
Why'd you think it was a joke?
Well, you know, out of... never met the man, never auditioned for the man, a dream that I never, you know, thought would come true kind of thing. And yet there it was.
So did you have to audition for him or did he just sign you?
The first time I met Woody Allen was on the set, my first day of work, and he was down the hall. It was what they call a dolly shot where the camera is on tracks and is moving, and he was down the hall figuring out his shot, and I looked, you know, out of the doorway at him and waved, and he waved back, and that's how I met Woody Allen.
I want to ask you about the Tracy Ullman show where you worked for several years. Now, mm-hmm. how did you get on that show, in which you had a chance to play all kinds of characters?
That was the best and hardest. It was the hardest work I've ever done. It was like going back to school and being paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
The education was just ongoing for the 3.5 years that we did the show, or 4 years, I think 3.5. At any rate, we were all of us required to do characters, I mean, on such a wide range, and wigs and prosthetics and padding and no padding and accents and singing and dancing and, I mean, things that we had never done before, that I had never done before. And the widest range of work I have ever done, and I think it really opened me up. I'm very grateful to have been a part of that show.
Now, you did sing on the Tracy Ullman show.
Yes,
for certain
ma'am.
Roles. And the new movie that you're in, I'll Do Anything, was originally a musical. Did you have songs in that?
I had one song. I had a ballad.
Do you remember how it went?
Well, yes, I do, because I sang it for a year. But if you think I'm going to sing it over the radio...
I've got another thing coming, huh?
Yes, yeah, so to speak.
Did you take singing lessons for it or anything?
I took singing lessons for the movie, which was also... I mean, I you know, being an actor is a pretty great job. It was invaluable. I'll have it for the rest of my life.
Speaking of voices,
yeah,
The Simpsons originated on the Tracy Ullman show.
Right.
And that's when you were first asked to play Marge Simpson.
Mm-hmm.
What was your first reaction to the concept of being the voice of Marge?
Well, again, that was in, for the very first show, we had 10 days. And it was, you know, the very, very beginning of the process of figuring out what the show should be. And it was just one more thing that we were asked to do that we had never done, or that I had never done before. And it was a wonderful cartoon and a wonderful family from the mind of Matt Groening. It was based on his vision of himself in his family. And it was, so it was terrific to begin with. And that voice came out of, before I took this wonderful year of singing lessons, I had very, very tired voice, and I just raised it a little bit and said, how about this for Marge? And they said, okay.
So how do you change your voice to become Marge?
I roughen it up and I raise it a bit. I raise it an octave or so.
Can you do a little
more? Well, it's just kind of up there like that and a little more tired.
Right. Now, does it hurt your voice to do that?
Not at all. The sisters, on the other hand, the two twin sisters, are an octave lower. Do I have a range or what, Terry?
You want to do one of the sisters?
Well, they happen to be my favorites.
Oh, that's great. You have a wonderful voice. Was your voice husky when you were young?
Yeah, I was born this way. I came out of my mom and said, hello, Rose. Hello, Dave.
But did you have a deep voice when you were young?
Yeah, they used to send me home. They always used to think I had laryngitis.
Oh, the nurses? Or...
Mm-hmm.
You have a very New York voice, but you grew up in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Well, Rose and Dave, who I just mentioned to you, my
parents, yeah.
They're from New York, and they taught me how to speak English. You see, so that's why I sound like this, as opposed to something lovely.
Now, what brought your parents to Los Angeles?
Well, it was after, they moved to L.A. in the 40s, so it was after the war, and just work and wanting to leave the East Coast.
What do they do for a living?
My dad's a furniture manufacturer and salesman, and my mom is a family counselor.
So when you were growing up in L.A., did you go to Beverly Hills High?
Yep, I did.
Was status in school related at all to the status of parents?
Yes, it was. Everything you think about Beverly Hills and that high school, and I hated it. I hated all of it. I hated it.
So
I think I'll say it again.
Yeah.
I hated it.
Did you like it?
No, Terry. I really hated it.
So having your father in the furniture business kind of guaranteed you a lower status in school?
Well, there were a lot of rich kids, you know, a lot of cliques going on and a lot of stuff like that, which I think affects people of that age. I don't think you can completely... I mean, I had a couple of friends.
So do you know what you'll be doing for your next role?
Well, I get to work with Mr. Woody Allen again.
On a
project that he's doing. I don't know if I should... I don't know if this has been released yet or not. I'm very protective of the man, so...
I know, and he hates to say what...
Yeah.
What scripts are about, so I won't push you on that.
Okay.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Julie Kavner co-stars in the new comedy, I'll Do Anything. This is Fresh Air. Louis Farrakhan held a press conference today about his spokesperson's anti-Semitic comments in a speech given last year. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will you have on that press conference on All Things Considered?
We'll have a report on the press conference by Phyllis Crockett. In it, Minister Farrakhan dismissed the speaker as a minister and as his spokesman, but didn't disown him and said that he had presented truths in such a way that would be offensive to people, and thereby that wouldn't serve the purpose of propagating the truth. But then Mr. Farrakhan himself made many, many anti-Jewish remarks in the course of the statement. Also today, a report on the Fatah Hawks, armed group in Gaza. And Dominic Argento explains why, if you can hum a tune from his opera, the opera doesn't work.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. February is another sweeps month, which means the networks are doing everything they can to get attention and ratings. TV critic David Bianculli says tonight the networks exerting the most effort are CBS and NBC.
If you're my age, 40 or older, you probably know that music, even if you haven't heard it in about 25 years. It's the theme to I Spy, which starred Bill Cosby and Robert Culp as globe-trotting, tennis-playing spies. And tonight, CBS leads off the evening with I Spy Returns, a new telemovie re-teaming Cosby and Culp and turning over the reins to the next generation of characters. It's a pleasant enough program as TV reunions go. But in this cutthroat competition for viewers, this special CBS telemovie loses out to NBC's regular lineup of sitcoms, starting with Mad About You, which stars Paul Reiser and Helen Hunt as Paul and Jamie, two happily married yet often arguing New Yorkers. Tonight's plot has Paul and Jamie fighting over whether to invest in a virtual reality device. Over the course of the show, each of them gets to dive into a pre-programmed fantasy and interact with people and places as though they were real. Paul sits in a chair, puts on a helmet, manipulates some buttons, and presto, he ends up on a beach with a digitized sky and sun, weird-looking waves, and a very nice-looking companion, Christie Brinkley, who plays this fantasy image of herself, garter belts and all.
You know, if you don't mind, I'd love for you to rub some of this oil on my back.
I just like this so much.
You know, it's okay to do it hard.
Sorry, am I being too gentle?
No, it's just perfect. I just want you to know that you can't do it too hard or too soft. Everything you do is just right.
That's what I think. Thank you.
Tell me about your work.
Are you kidding me?
No, I want you to rub my back while talking about you.
It's a great show with way too many surprises to ruin. The same goes for tonight's Frasier, which temporarily reunites Kelsey Grammer's Frasier with his ex-wife Lilith, who comes to visit Seattle. Bebe Neuwirth, as Lilith, was always one of my favorite characters on Cheers, and Frasier was another, so it's great to see them together again. He does his best slow burns after comments of hers, and she's as tightly wound as her hair bun. As a couple, they're like fire and ice. Best of all, though, is the way Lilith interacts with the other cast members of Frasier, including John Mahoney, who plays Frasier's father, Martin.
Martin, I'm especially delighted to see you here tonight.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yes. Knowing as I do the history of your relationship with Frasier, when I heard that he'd taken you in, I immediately flipped to the Weather Channel to see if hell had indeed frozen over.
Frasier, how'd you ever let this little peach get away?
NBC also has a new episode of Seinfeld, which wasn't available for preview, about George's new puffy coat. A sort of sequel, I guess, to the episode about Jerry's puffy shirt. When it comes to this particular night of television, it may be the old I Spy I remember, but it's the new NBC sitcoms I watch.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, and Naomi Person, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. Research assistants from Louisa Shafia, Ann Neville, and Devin Reif are our interns. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, it's the John Updike Show. We feature interviews from the archives with Updike, as well as a new interview about his new novel, Brazil. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.